basically. And so what's happening right now is these really violent settlers are going out into the fields. They're stealing land from Palestinians, attacking people. Every once in a while, the Israeli government will condemn them. But then what happens is they turn around and they retroactively legalize the land that was stolen and basically reward the violent settlers by giving them the state of the stamp of state legitimacy. And then, you know, within weeks, months, years, you have a new settlement right there where the violent settlers had, you know, gone out and stolen the land.
We're going to do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org, where I'm going to ask you about Mohammed Ibrahim, the Palestinian-American teenager released from an Israeli military prison in late November after more than 9 months in custody without trial. Palestinian-American, you've just come from Florida, where you spent time with him. Jasper Nathaniel, New York-based writer and reporter who covers Israel's occupation of the West Bank on his Substack called Infinite Jazz. And we'll talk about your new piece, Israel's Archaeological Apartheid. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Yusra Rizuki. We have job openings at Democracy Now! For video news production and digital fellowship programs, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, going on now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than by gifting your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
Hey, good morning, and welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, and I'm joined, as I am each and every week, by Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
So it's the holiday season, so we decided we would take a short departure from our typical practice of surveying the wreckage of the second Trump administration to bring in a very special guest. Tracy, why don't you tell our listeners who we have for them today?
Yes. So we are very excited today to have a conversation with Lisa, Dr. Lisa DiGiovanni, who wrote a really good book. And so we're talking about the book Militarized Masculinity in Spain and Chile. And we're going to talk to Dr. Giovanni about how she formulated this book and really help bring some parallels from history regarding the book and where we're at in this moment in U.S. history with, you know, moving the Department of Defense to the Department of War, blowing up ships in Venezuela, you know, the kind of the machismo of the moment within the Trump administration, you know, bearing all of the blackouts that we see on Grindr when these folks get together, but really talking about, like, where are the parallels and how do we see the current moment in time of this extra masculine movement, and I say that in air quotes, of the Trump administration and the Trump regime, really mirroring some of our past movements as well. So I will stop there and say welcome, Dr. DiGiovanni.
Thank you so much for having me and for your interest in this topic.
Yes.
About the development of the book and the parallels. So we can start out with the actual writing of the book took place over the past 4 or 5 years or so, but the roots of my interest in this topic go way back. I'm 48, so 30 years ago when I was 18, I traveled to Guatemala, and that was in 1996. I knew that I wanted to learn Spanish and travel the world. I didn't know that Guatemala was actually ending a very bloody civil war. Actually, it was state violence against the indigenous people and the leftist population. That was in 1996, so I quickly learned about the genocide, and I returned to the U.S., and I was hooked on Latin American studies, and so I continued to study politics and history and culture. I traveled to Ecuador, and then later I did a master's degree in Spain and learned about the Franco regime. That was in 2000. And I wanted to keep learning, so I started a PhD at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Yay! So I did a PhD in Romance Languages and Literatures with a focus on Latin American dictatorships. And I did a transatlantic study looking at Chile and Spain. Just after I finished my PhD, I gained a more intersectional, a deeper lens, because I decided to do a graduate certificate in women's and gender studies. And that was so important because it allowed me to analyze violence in new ways and see things that I wasn't seeing before. I started to really see the link between authoritarianism, militarism, gender, and making these links. And that's when I discovered the term, coined by Cynthia Enloe, a political scientist, militarized masculinity. And so militarized masculinity is a learned identity that's rooted in nationalism. I came to see this as really at the root of so many of the regimes that I had studied in Latin America and Europe as well. So as a mindset, it emphasizes physical strength, dominance over women and other men, stoicism, the willingness to use violence to solve political problems. That's probably the most key. Willingness to use violence to solve political or social problems. And it's most often in the name of national security and nationalism, patriotism, and so on. So that's kind of the development of the book. Over time, I found that literature and film from Chile and Spain, they, in the wake of these dictatorial regimes, they present these very violent pasts in ways that make us think differently. They make us think critically about these different connections. And so that's how I kind of connected the dots between gender, militarism, authoritarianism. And that's how the book came to be.
Wow, thank you. So, you know, you kind of write about, you know, these intersections, right? These intersections. Mm-hmm. And I want to take us to like where we are right now in the United mm-hmm. States, and where do you see like the timelines like connecting with yes. The current, you know, fascist moment we're in with the MAGA movement?
Right. So let's look at Spain first, and then mm-hmm. I'll make a connection to the United States. So if you look at Spain in the 1930s, it was marked by massive social change, really exciting. I mean, think of painters like Salvador Dalí and Pablo Picasso, writers like García Lorca. You had all of these very forward-thinking Spaniards that wanted to see Spain differently. They also wanted to close the gap between the rich and the poor. Many advocated for women's rights, the expansion of education for all. There was an enormous gap between the rich and the poor in Spain in the 1930s. And education was dominated by the Catholic Church. So there were many that wanted to focus more on science instead, the expansion of healthcare. So that momentum that started throughout the 1920s, but really came to fruition in 1931 with the establishment of the Second Republic, that momentum, that progressive momentum, was met with bitterness and fear by conservatives. So this was a backlash. We saw a backlash by the Catholic Church, by wealthy landowners who saw their power threatened. So the response was this nostalgic discourse. The response was all of these changes brought by modernity are a deviation from Spain's real identity, what Spain is supposed to be. So there was an emphasis on the restoration of traditional patriarchal values. And that nostalgic discourse was extremely powerful. And at the end of the day, it really solidified Spain's power hierarchies, but it was a very attractive discourse. So it wasn't just that the landed elite were interested in restoring traditional Spain. So there were a lot from the working class, middle class. So it wasn't just completely divided by class. So like in the United States, we see different classes on both sides of the political spectrum. So that nostalgic discourse was appealing. And so when we look at the parallels with the United States, that discourse is very anti-politics. So there's this view that politicians are corrupt and you need a strong man to come in and clean up these social problems and restore tradition. So they're authoritarian. These groups are authoritarian. These are some of the parallels that you are kind of asking me about. Very patriarchal. So that strong man is indeed a man. Men hold positions of power. Women are important, but they are in supporting roles, right? Yeah. And when they want to take the lead role, that's when the misogyny kicks in. They're also militaristic. They adopt uniforms, camouflage, language, militaristic language. There's overemphasis on us versus them. It's very anti-liberal, anti-feminist. ultra-nationalistic, imperialist as well. And another parallel is that Franco's Spain, those who supported the dictatorship, opposed cultural plurality, which is a key issue right now in the United States. The question of cultural plurality. In Spain, there isn't just one Spain. There are many Spains. There's Catalonia, they speak Catalan. There's Galicia, they speak Galician. El País Vasco, they speak Basque. And so there were many that wanted to recognize this cultural plurality, and others that wanted Castilian Spanish only, one Spain, and that was a very restrictive view. So I think that those are some of the parallels that we can see.
This is all starting this is all starting to sound very, very familiar. I'll go ahead and ask your question, Tracy, and I'll follow up.
I mean, I was going to ask, what about the racism? I mean, because of course in Spain, you have a multicultural society of people who all look alike, who all have similar ancestry, right? Like here, we're getting told that the reason we don't have healthcare is because immigrants get it. The reason we don't have housing is because immigrants who are taking all of the resources have bought them all. The reason we don't have any other nice things and inflation is high is because the immigrants, I mean, we're being gaslit into feeling like there is a scapegoat in the room, and it is people who are not originally from here, although none of us are originally from here.
So in the case of Spain and in the case of many Latin American dictatorships, it was the question, those foreigners were the socialists. And so I mean, think for example, this is a time, this is right before the Cold War, 1930s, you had very large communist parties throughout the world that were gaining momentum, and socialist and middle of the road Democrats that wanted deep social change. Well, they were framed as anti-Spaniards, they were framed as the Bolsheviks, the Reds. And so they were scapegoated as, they were the foreigners that were scapegoated, right? And so These growing leftist movements were a divergence from Spain's natural origins, and the military regime was looked to save Spain by steering it back to its essential roots that are not socialist, that are that actually maintain these very rigid hierarchies that many people saw as natural. So the enemies were internal: socialists, feminists, anarchists, modernist artists. And so those traditionalists viewed these groups as allowing the nation to become polluted and weak. And so in the United States, you have this mythologized post-war American exceptionalism, the golden 1950s. And you have the question of, race and class, this make America great again, it means like steering the country away from the rise of LGBTQ rights movements, racial equality, and so on. So I think that those parallels are really important. Scapegoating is always key.
Oh, yeah. So always needs to be a scapegoat to rally the folks around. Yeah, go ahead, Abe. Yes.
So you mentioned these explicit appeals to a nostalgic past that seemed to accompany the rise of fascist movements. Yes. In Franco's Spain, it was Spain's imperialist past when they rose to prominence and became the most powerful nation in Europe, and at that time, by extension, the most powerful nation in the world. In the United States, President Trump likes to talk about the McKinley presidency, which was coincided with the height of American imperialism. But I think in the minds of his supporters, what they're hearkening back to is what you mentioned in your last answer, this golden age of the 1950s, when white, straight Christian males were unopposed in their supremacy. And there was this this monoculture that predominated everything. If you turned on one of your three television channels, chances are you would see a lot of straight white Christian people on it. So is nostalgia for that era, that post-war era, is that what's animating the MAGA movement here?
I believe so. I believe that it certainly is. But I think that your point earlier is part of the equation as well. Right now, it's amazing that they're talking about this administration is hearkening back to the Monroe Doctrine. Monroe Doctrine, which was really, you see the rise of American expansionism. You see the view that the United States has at its backyard, Latin America, and that there were goods to be had, deals to be made in Latin America, but always with the U.S. as being dominant, right? So I certainly think that it's the nostalgia is multifaceted. You have the golden 50s, you have the Rough Riders, Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, and the rise of U.S. influence in Cuba and the rest of Latin America. So nostalgia, it can include multiple different time periods. And I think that one key factor about nostalgia is that it's not so specific. So there aren't any like resolutions to problems in these nostalgic discourses, like real policy resolutions to, inequality, social, political inequality, environmental destruction, global shifts. None of these are adequately dealt with. Instead, you just have this kind of vague calling for a past that we need to return to.
So it doesn't really matter the details of that past. It only matters that it's portrayed as better than things are today.
Exactly. So nostalgia, actually, my first book is about nostalgia. It's called Unsettling Nostalgia. And I state there that nostalgia says more about the present than it does about the past. It says something about what people are perceiving is missing from the present. So in this case, it's like this, the battle of good and evil, and a pure versus unpure, traditional, wholesome versus corrupt, and so on. So it really, nostalgia says more about the present than it does about the past.
That's fascinating. So I want to ask you also about the term that you use frequently in your writings, which is militarized masculinity.
Yes.
I've heard a number of different descriptors applied to various strains of masculinity that are perceived as toxic or virulent or oppressive. But militarized masculinity is something new to me. And yes, it seems to have specific meaning and resonance in the context of a fascist movement. Could you talk a little bit more about militarized masculinity, how it arises and how it's relevant to what we're experiencing right now?
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right in making the connection between militarized masculinity and toxic masculinity. It's not the exact same thing. They're not entirely one, but they're also not entirely two. So if we think about militarized masculinity as a socially constructed identity that's learned in media, different institutions, the toys boys play with, and so on, it's an identity and a mindset that's associated with aggression, combat skills, dominance, nationalism, physical strength, and the ability to voluntarily use violence to solve social and political problems or conflicts. So militarized masculinity does not have to be confined to the barracks. I think that this is important. So not all those who are militarized are in uniform. Men and women can be militarized and can really support this militarized masculine ideal. If we look over time, militarized masculinity, I mean, I focus on how it pervades the right wing and fascist movements. But to be fair, militarized masculinity also defined Stalin's reign of terror. And it also defines Putin. Putin is a wonderful example of a militarized, well, terrible example of a militarized male. And so I think that more broadly, we need to link militarism, masculinity, and authoritarianism more broadly. So we can look at a variety of groups. So take, for instance, the black shirts in Mussolini's Italy. You have this militarized masculinity at the core. Mussolini and Hitler both returned from World War I wanting to bring the fight home. I think that we can see a parallel with that in the United States as well. So many of the insurrectionists on the Capitol on January 6th actually were veterans that wanted to bring the battle home. So Mussolini's black shirts and the brown shirts in Italy, I'm sorry, in Hitler's Germany, they saw fighting as a way of life, as an actual value. At the heart, they were military men. You also see this in Latin America, Somoza in Nicaragua, Pinochet in Chile, Rios Montt in Guatemala, Idi Amin in Uganda, Milosevic in Serbia. These are all militarized men to their core. So they adopt an us versus them mentality. This kind of normalization of aggression runs through all of these regimes. And so it's really about a belief system, a glorification of the military man as the ideal man, right? And that actually unites soldiers, this belief system, I would say, in the United States and in all of these different contexts that I just mentioned. That belief system is actually a unifying factor in the making of genocidal leaders, of rank and file perpetrators, of civilian bystanders. This glorification of the military, vilification of politicians and intellectuals, and the idea that a strong man needs to come in and clean up the mess.
When you laid out like that, it's really, you can really see how important the role of nostalgia is in these sorts of movements, and how effective leaders of fascist movements are able to use the symbols of that glorified past. It's your example. I was thinking about this when you mentioned Mussolini in particular. I mean, even the word fascism is derived from the fasces, which were a symbol of office for high-ranking Romans in the Republican era. So that was no accident that he chose that term, and also no accident that he explicitly employed symbols of ancient Rome to justify his rule. It all fits together in your analysis. It's fascinating.
I'm so glad that you see that. Certainly. And I mean, going back to Mussolini, we can work in the idea of misogyny. So Mussolini was a terrible womanizer. He really saw conquest of nations and conquest of women as being the ultimate sign of masculinity. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. I think that the president that we have right now has the same view.
Well, that was my question, because I'm thinking, like, President Bone Spurs doesn't have a military bone in his body. Has never served in the military. Does not know anything about the military beyond, you know, probably most of what anybody else would know, read in books or heard about. You know, I'm hearing what you're saying about the womanizing. And of course, now we're talking about the Epstein files, and not just womanizing grown women, but a predator of young girls, and how that is also being normalized in backlash to the Me Too movement, where women who have historically been the ones who have been pursued and mistreated, abused, raped, said, absolutely, not anymore. We're not doing this. And so we're also, to me, in the backlash to Me Too, yes. in this misogynous movement that we're in, where yes. even, you know, the new Department of Defense is saying, oh no, you can harass people now. It's yeah. okay to harass people, because we know who's going to get harassed the most, who's right. already getting harassed is women.
Right.
Fascinating.
Right. So, but I want to back up to something you said. You're right that President Trump does not have military experience, but this is so important to keep in mind. He was formed in a military academy. A lot of people overlook this. He was put into a military academy by his very dominant father. Mm-hmm. He was getting into a lot of fights. And so you see the toxic masculinity, the from a very young age. Trump, there's a wonderful Frontline documentary that you should check out that highlights this foundational moment for Trump when he was sent as a young man. I think maybe he was, 12 or 13. Don't quote me on that. He was sent to a military academy. And in that military academy, he learned discipline, the value of hierarchies, the repression of emotions, that stoicism was a value, that you never admit you're wrong, that you never show any kind of weakness, that soldiers are men and they're tough, and civilians are weak and feminine. He learned all of those things in the military academy. So I don't think we should ignore that. I think it's really foundational for him.
Absolutely. I had never heard that. He presents himself as the strong man.
Yes.
And I just never really understood that. So yeah, I'll have to go look that up.
Yes.
What the prevailing thought right now is that Trump as the figurehead, right? Trumpism and the MAGA movement are only illuminated because Trump exists. And of course, this man is towards the end of his life. If you've seen, you know, the sores on his hand or him sleeping in public meetings, right, there's scuttle of his health, his mental health deteriorating, all of this. And people saying, like, if he is no longer here, which he will not be at one point, this movement will die. What do you think about that kind of analysis?
No, I sadly, I don't think so. I think that when I teach students, I tell them, you know, we can never leave the dictators alone. We can't just talk about Pinochet or Franco or Hitler as these monsters that took over and committed all of these terrible acts. And those that racism was born with them and it died with them as well. It's just not that simple, sadly. These authoritarians are supported by a population that has ingrained views, ingrained racist views, sexist views, classist views. And so it was always simmering. I think that Trump gave so many people license to say certain things in the most brutal way. And I think that was, it's been devastating for this country. It's been very important, that normalization, but it wasn't born with Trump. It was there. It's just that instead of moving to cut these roots that we have, because our country is founded on a lot of, you know, wonderful ideals, but also on slavery and on misogyny. Mm. So instead of, you know, cutting off some of those roots that are deeply ingrained in society, in institutions, in education, in worldviews, instead of cutting those rooted ideas off, Trump watered them. He watered them, and they're growing and growing. And so when something happens to Trump, we have all of these plants that are, you know, fully grown, and we need to address all of those problems. It's not just a question of blaming one person. I think that's way too simplistic. Sadly, we have a long haul, I think, in the United States in changing some of the damage that has been done.
You're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. We are here today with Dr. Lisa DiGiovanni, the author of Militarized Masculinity in Spain and Chile, Remembering Violence Through Film and Literature. Lisa, I got to say that, you know, that as a man, men are not coming off very well in your analysis, fortunately. So, well, my question is, this sort of militarized masculinity that you describe, is this an irreducible component of fascism? Can you have a fascist movement without this sort of masculine energy animating it?
Well, first I want to go back to what you said about being a man.
Sure.
This is really an important point to bring out. There are multiple masculinities. The whole idea of my book is that these ideas around masculinity are learned, and not all boys and men embrace those ideas. So you might not embrace those ideas. There are multiple masculinities and multiple femininities. These are not innate qualities. This is a mindset. This is a belief system. This is a way of thinking. So I certainly believe that there can be women who are militarized and women who are anti-militaristic, men who are militarized and men who are anti-militaristic, anti-toxic masculinity. So I always want to emphasize that, because I think that men can be put off by this term and feel excluded. But men are actually a key component in our resistance to militarized masculinity. It can't and it will not come only from women. There are plenty of women that actually glorify the view of men as soldiers only, right? So I think that we need to think in broader terms about masculinity and femininity. There are multiple. Okay, so that's the first point, that that certainly men can be just as critical of militarized masculinity as women can. Okay, so to your next question about is this militarized masculinity at the core of all fascist movements? Well, militarism is absolutely at the core of fascism. Militarism is at the core of fascism, and militarism is the idea that that violence is the most effective solution to political conflict. I said this earlier in the interview, and you mentioned, for instance, the bombing of, you know, the way we're dealing with the situation in the Caribbean and Venezuela, the way we're dealing with immigration in this country. It's the view that all of those things should be tackled.
Yes.
Militarily, right? So yes, it absolutely is at the core. I don't think that there's anything more core in fascism as militarism. And I think that militarism is absent from our discussion, and we need to talk about militarism more as a mindset. The United States isn't North Korea. We're not fully militarized, but militarism is a belief system, an ideology, which is linked to authoritarianism, because, you know, we're talking about hierarchies, the idea that politics doesn't work, that a military man needs to come in and rule. That's very much alive in the United States. So militarism is an ideology, militarized masculinity is an identity, and militarization is a process. And we're not a fully militarized nation, but it's very scary to see the National Guard moving into cities like Portland. Yeah. And those are big warning signs. When we hear the Department of Defense being renamed the Department of War, as Tracy mentioned at the beginning of the segment, we see the purging of military officials that actually see the military as apolitical, because the military, the armed forces, and there are many people in the armed forces that believe this. I don't want to villainize everyone in the military. No, but there are two different views of the function of the military. One is that it is apolitical and it serves to uphold the Constitution. And the other view is that the armed forces should have an active role in politics. And that second view is what permeated all of these different Latin American societies and led to terrible, terrible consequences. Genocide, politicide, mass violence. And so in the United States right now, we're not only seeing the militarization of cities through the National Guard. We're seeing, as I started to say earlier, the purging of military officials, high-ranking military officials that are for the apolitical role. So keep your eye out for, you know, these news headlines about who Pete Hegseth is giving power to and who is being marginalized within the armed forces. This is so important because in the case of Spain, there was a civil war. There wasn't just a successful military coup in 1936 when there was this military backlash. There was a civil war because the military was split. The military on one side, they were loyalists to the Republican, democratically elected government. So they defended the apolitical role of the military and just defended democracy, right? But then the other half of the military in Spain supported the insurrectionists. In this case, they were called the rebels, the military rebels that rebelled against democracy. And so therefore, there was a three-year, very bloody war. The fascists, Franco, was supported by Mussolini and Hitler, and the Republic was kind of left alone because of the Non-Intervention Act. So the United States didn't want to get involved, and England didn't want to get involved. France didn't want to get involved. But it was a civil war because the military was split. In the case of Chile, very briefly, and then I'll wrap up this answer. In the case of Chile, there wasn't a civil war because Pinochet was very strategic and purged different military officials that held up constitutional democracy, that were certainly going to oppose a military coup. So these are all really important things that we need to pay attention to right now in the United States. History can teach us so much.
I mean, history repeats. And I think what I'm also being fascinated by is this, in the spirit of nostalgia, masking history, right? Yeah. The people who are currently acting like Nazis. And I think the parallel that I am consistently making is, you know, the rise of Hitler in Germany and Hitler's circle of henchmen and evil, right? But this idea that you can mask history and rewrite history so that you position yourself as the ultimate victor, fascinating, right? History yes. repeats until yes. we know yeah. what these patterns are.
Yes.
I want to ask the question, Lisa, like, how do we use this analysis to form a coherent resistance? right? Mm-hmm. We've been talking about resistance 2016. Yeah. What does that actually look like? Because it feels like the levers of resistance within the media, the levers of resistance within the political sphere, they're all falling down.
Yes, you're right. And it can feel very disheartening. But we need to keep in mind that resistance comes in so many different packages, in so many different ways you can resist. So I think that, first of all, we need to start with ourselves and our own thinking. So question assumptions about the military and ingrained beliefs that military force is the most effective solution to social problems. So actively question that and press our elected officials to not take that militaristic path. We need to reframe the military in our heads as a peacekeeping institution, not a Department of War. I think that we need to resist the glorification of violence. And this, you can do this in a lot of different ways. So we need to be more critical of the media that we consume. For instance, we can seek out forms of entertainment that don't glorify war and different forms of violence. We can seek out forms of entertainment, films, novels, shows, so on, that challenge stereotypes, that offer multiple perspectives, that don't paint the world in black and white, that bring out the complexity of societal problems and nonviolent solutions to those conflicts. We can also teach new values to our children that focus on the importance of dialogue over force instead of force, and the importance of emotional awareness and creative problem solving. We can speak out against microaggressions, jokes against feminist women and non-military men, homophobic jokes. These are all very interconnected problems, and we need to see them as interconnected problems. We need to recognize the connection between these different forms of violence: misogyny, rape culture, homophobia, transphobia. These are all interconnected, and until we start looking at some of these relationships, we're not going to be able to make significant change. So there's definitely a connection between our gun culture and militarism in this country. All of these ideas contribute to the making of militarized masculinity, and these are all learned, but the good thing is they can be unlearned. So if they're constructed, they're not natural, they can be unmade, right? And it's through our thinking that we can change these things.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that. When you characterized a militarized masculinity earlier in our conversation as a learned behavior, that really stuck with me, because as you just mentioned, learned behaviors can be unlearned. And yes. I think the point you made about gun culture in the United States, I think is really key to understanding this whole analysis. A militarized masculinity at large in the public is a far more dangerous proposition when there are a whole lot of guns lying around.
Exactly.
I mean, that's, yes. That is absolutely true.
Yes.
But in terms of unlearning these things, I'm sure I'm not alone when I say that there are people in my family and even in my extended group of peers who have who have swallowed the MAGA pill and who are on board with Trump and his movement. Mm-hmm. So in terms of helping these people, whom I care about, and I'm sure many other people have figures in their lives that they care about as well, how do we help them to unlearn this sort of thing? Are there models of positive masculinity you can think of that we can point to and emulate?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that right now democracy is being challenged, and we need to believe in democracy. That's one of the foundations of anti-fascism is democracy. So fascists are anti-democratic. I mean, that's core. So we need to believe in democracy, believe in the notion that complex problems require complex solutions and long-term nonviolent solutions. So there are so many people that are frustrated with good reason with politics and kind of the disorder in and the political infighting and the swinging back and forth. Nothing seems to get done, and one step forward, two steps back. That actually giving into that gives into, like, it allows for the erosion of democracy. If you don't believe that democracy works, then you're falling into a mentality that some kind of authoritarianism might work. So we need to actively talk about that in very clear terms with those people who we know would otherwise support democracy. So to bring out in different conversations in a very diplomatic way the contradictions in what people say. Democracy does take work. And so to challenge the notion that a strong man leader will just simply save the nation, we need to, like, really challenge that notion. And I think that we're so immersed in these ideas. It's like the water we swim in and the air we breathe. That's why we don't talk about militarism or militarized masculinity, because it's kind of everywhere. It's so pervasive that it's invisible. It's so pervasive that we don't even see it. And so unlearning it, to your question, requires critical thinking and strategies to help others critically think about their assumptions. And I mean, I think education is enormous. I mean, that's why I'm an educator. I help students think about their own assumptions and sometimes their own fascist thinking, and kind of what are the reasons why that is a dead end road. Are you there?
Yes, absolutely. I'm thinking about also the fact that education, especially higher education, is right now under attack, right?
Exactly.
We're attacking history. We're attacking education. We're making people so crippled by the circumstances of their everyday lives, right? Through, enforcing poverty, right? These are all policy choices.
Yes.
And people who are crushed by poverty, who might get caught up in the scapegoating of others because of the material conditions of their own lives. It's the perfect storm. And without a faith in democracy, we really subject ourselves to even worse conditions for the future.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Education, we see right now, stricter control over curriculum. Education is absolutely key. The demonizing of educators, the demonizing of intellectuals, of research. I mean, those institutions are, education is being challenged because it is the most effective solution to some of these larger problems. It is, I think, the approach that we need to take to reduce inequality, to improve the daily lives of citizens in this country. It's about learning new skills, which need to be developed in higher ed. I mean, right now with AI, we need to think in very clear ways about what humans can do right now that computers can't do. Critically thinking very creatively about solving complex problems. Those things can happen in the classroom, in classes that are traditionally in the humanities. And the humanities, of course, they're being villainized and also trivialized, being seen as soft skills that are not important in today's economy. But that's all wrong, because the skills that you learn in humanities-centered courses, they help you critically think, to be nimble, to shift. Say you lose your job, you can shift into something else if you have an array of skills that you learn in these different university courses. So it's very short-sighted to see the humanities as being worthless. So, education is absolutely key.
It's no accident, is it, that those areas of scholarship that are coming under the most scrutiny from the MAGA movement are those disciplines which explicitly critique the sort of militarized masculine dominance that Trump and his movement evidence. I mean, things like women's studies, gender studies, racial studies, even more broadly speaking, historical analyses that teach anything other than the triumphalist American narrative that we're all familiar with. I mean, that's considering those things in this context, that's no accident. They don't want people talking about these things in these sorts of ways because it represents a direct challenge to the worldview that they are trying to calcify and make ascendant for the foreseeable future. That's not an accident.
That's right. And I mean, in those classes, also we learn about how capitalism plays into this as well. So if we look at environmental destruction, if we look at the kind of some of the core beliefs behind cutthroat capitalism, and of course, capitalism can include socialist ideas. And, you know, that's why we have so many of our, you know, social safety net institutions in the United States. But cutthroat capitalism is focused on competition. It's focused on us versus them. It's very nationalistic. Environmental destruction plays a role in this too. So militarized masculinity, nationalism, imperialism, the conquering of lands, the conquering of resources, the conquering of women, all of these being signs of being a real man, we need to connect these dots. You see what I mean?
If real men don't have gold filigreed ballrooms, I think I'm going to come out and say that.
That's right. I mean, so many contradictions, right? So many contradictions. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Okay, we're running out of time. Dr. Giovanni, where can we find this book? What should we do with the book? How do we form, you know, like a group, a read and conversations about what does this look like for us in resistance? Bring us home.
So my book is published by University Press, and University Presses famously charge a lot for books that initially come out in hardcover. So right now my book is available through the University of Toronto Press in hardcover, but the more that it is purchased, the sooner it will get to paperback, which will bring down the price from about $70 to maybe $30. You can purchase the book and create some reviews, in favor or critical of it, to get the word out there. I think that we need to get the term militarized masculinity out there into the ether. We need to foreground it. This is not my term. My book is the first book-length study of militarized masculinity in this comparative framework like this. It was actually Cynthia Enloe's term, and she drew from others as well. To get that term out into the public, I want to start hearing it more, making those connections. It's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So, University Press.
Yes.
Find the book if you have the resources.
Yes.
Share it with others.
Yes, it's on Amazon as well. Sorry to interrupt you, but it's on Amazon. And the more that it is purchased, also the more you can get a used copy and so on. So form a a reading group. Also, I should say that if you Google my name, you could find articles that I have published that are standalone articles on this topic that you can just download for free. I also would point your attention to the amazing work of Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who has a book called Strong Men. Pretty soon here, she is going to feature my op-ed on her platform, Lucid. But she's a history professor, a faculty at NYU, and her work is just brilliant. So Strong Men is another book that I highly recommend.
Well, Dr. Lisa Giovanni, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you this morning. And I'm grateful that you're out there doing this sort of scholarship. And I really hope that that your book goes into wide circulation and then we can start collectively unlearning the many bad habits that got us to where we are right now.
Yes. Thank you so much. It was such an interesting conversation.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. That brings us to the end of the program. Tracy, send us home.
Well, you know, it's about to be, you know, a holiday coming up. There are a lot of people in need this holiday season. And oftentimes, right, we flock to do it right at the holiday season. But guess what? There's still going to be a need in January and February. So start thinking, if you have extra resources or time, please donate your time, donate your extra resources, check on people, check on your elders, check on your unsheltered neighbors, check on the plants and animals. It's going to get really cold as well. So just imagine being unsheltered. It's about to be in the 30s overnight. There's going to be a windstorm on Wednesday. Please do what you can to create that community care that we talk about every week. If you love hearing what we have to say on this program as well, please give to KBOO Radio. It's the last bastion of the ability to have dialogue and community and do it at the benefit of community. So please, if you have the ability to give to KBOO, we are trying to reach a goal. I don't remember what that goal is at the moment, but we need your support.
This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Thank you for tuning in. Have a happy holiday season, whatever holiday it is that you celebrate.